On average day, our hands touch literally hundreds of surfaces. Because of how we use our hands every single day, maybe we're outside the house, maybe we're around the house, because of how we use our hands, each day they are often covered with germs. Here's some fast facts about hand germs. Germs can survive for up to 3 hours on our hands. Between 2 and 10 million bacteria are on our fingertips and elbows. Now that's a bunch. The number of germs in our fingertips doubles after we use a toilet. If we don't wash our hands, we transfer germs to our food and drink. Long before Jesus came into the world, people were washing their hands. People were thinking about hand washing. And we know that because in the Bible, in the Old Testament, we read about the washing of hands. We read about the washing of body parts, if you will. When you engage in a thorough study of Jesus' life, you also read about the washing of hands. Jesus came into a world where people were accustomed to washing their hands, they washed pots, they washed pans, there were a number of ceremonial washings. In fact, if you were to look at the book of Luke, Luke chapter 11, verses 37 and 38, you'd find these verses. Now as he spake, there was a Pharisee who asked him, that's Jesus, to dine with him. So Jesus accepts the meal invitation, and Jesus goes to this man's house. The Lord begins to sit down and prepare to eat. And, or we might even say, but when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled. He was surprised. He was shocked. He was astounded. Why? Because the Lord did not first bathe himself before dinner. Now, this is a place where the translation perhaps needs to be checked with another version or two. The word bathe does not here mean cover yourself with water. It doesn't mean get in the bathtub and soak for a while. This verse does not mean that Jesus never took a shower. The information in Luke chapter 11, verses 37 and 38 is explained in a little more detail in another text, and that's Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. Mark, on a different occasion, says this, there were gathered together unto him the Pharisees, and there were some scribes, and these men had come from Jerusalem. And it seemed that some of his disciples ate their bread with defiled hands. That is, they did not eat the bread with ceremonially washed hands. And then in verse 3, Mark has a little bit of an explanation. He says, for the Pharisees, and not just them, he says, all the Jews, except or unless they wash their hands, and not only do they wash their hands, but he said they diligently wash their hands in this ceremonial way before they eat, because that was according to the tradition of the elders. The Jews, obviously, information about germs came much later than 2,000 years ago. But the Jews, they were not, when they were doing all these washings, they were not thinking about germs. When you look at Mark chapter 7, Luke chapter 11, the Bible tells us that they were washing their hands for religious purposes. This was an expected ritual. And it was such an established and expected ritual that if you went to a meal, if you were out and you were going to eat food, it wasn't just bread in the sense that we think of bread from a wrapper package, but if you were going to go out and you were going to drink something, if you were going to eat something, if you were drinking something, then that cup or whatever it was, it needed to be washed. And if you were certainly going to eat something, you would be expected to go through this ceremonial washing. Now, I don't have on the slide Mark chapter 7 and verse 4. But if we had that additional information up there, you would see that as Mark's account continues, he goes on to talk about not just the hands, but he makes it clear that they wash the pots and they wash the pans and they wash the dishes as part of that ceremonial act. The concept of ritual purity is sort of a foreign concept to us. But for the Jews, this was a big, big deal. By the time of the first century, the Jews, they had elevated the concept of ritual purity to an entirely new level, certainly to a place where God never intended it to be. Have you ever seen a doctor scrub? I've seen that a couple of times in my life where there was a physician going in to perform a procedure and he said or she said or they said, we need to scrub. Now, if you've never seen that or you've never thought about the process, here is the process as described by someone who is actually a physician. This doctor said, I go through a rigid routine. Anytime I'm going to operate on somebody, if I'm going to put my hands into a person's body, this is what I do every single time. Number one, I wash my hands with a sterile scrub brush. So I get this brush, it's sterile, and I just start scrubbing my hands. And then he said, after I do that, I scrub under each fingertip. And then I scrub under each nail. Following that, I scrub between each finger. And then I start working on the knuckles. I scrub them. I scrub first with the finger straight, and then I scrub with my fingers flexed. He knows that germs might be hiding in those creases. And then he says, I get up there and I start scrubbing the elbows. And then after all that scrubbing, I'm not done. I go back and I repeat the process. after all of that cleansing, then I dip my hands in alcohol. And then after I've dipped my hands in alcohol, I raise them up. Don't want to put them down and let the alcohol drip down because you're going to have germs on the hands again. So I let the alcohol start to drain. And then my hands are dried with a sterile towel. Then there's an aide who comes along and helps me put on a sterile gown. And those rubber gloves, I have an assistant to help my hands get gloved. And then I have to don a mask. Ever wonder why a surgeon is so expensive? I'm not sure this really accounts for it, but they do go through a lot of effort to ensure that their hands are sterile. After all that, the doctor says, all right, my hands are good, I'm ready for surgery. But this doctor, if you were to go back and read what he wrote, he said, oftentimes, after all that prep, you get in the surgery suite and you're thinking everything is ready, but he said, that's not always how it works. There are some other people in there with a doc, and one of the people is probably going to be an anesthesiologist. This man had performed enough procedures where he said, I will tell you that there are times where the anesthesiologist says, now wait a minute, we can't proceed quite yet. The patient is not ready. We need to give him some more anesthetic or something else needs to be done. And as that doctor with those scrubbed, with those hands, which are germ-free for our illustration, as he is standing there thinking about things, he made the point, he says, sometimes I'd like to blow my nose. He said, sometimes as I'm standing there with my hands all pure, he said, there are times where my neck itches. And I just like to, you know, just go back there and just for a minute, scratch my neck once or twice. Or sometimes, apparently the man wears glasses and he said, you know, I'm going to be operating on the guy. I want to make sure I can see well. So I'm tempted sometimes just to adjust my glasses a little bit so I feel a little more comfortable. But the doc made this point. The surgeon said, I can't do any of those things because if I do, the level of sterility is not going to be maintained. So he said, what I do after I've gone through all this process, I close my hands together. And as much as I want to do some other stuff, I do not touch anything. If I did, I'd have to go through the sterilization process once again. Now let's take all of those steps. Let's keep all of those steps in mind. And suppose that tomorrow you need to go see the doctor. And the big appointment for tomorrow is the doctor is going to check your blood pressure. They just want to do a blood pressure follow-up. Now, you would expect that as you go to the doctor that they're not going to go through all the steps that we just outlined. Maybe the doctor, I doubt that even a doctor with kind of where we are as far as COVID would put on any gloves, but maybe they would do that. But chances are, especially if we were not concerned about COVID at this time in human history, doctor might squirt on a little hand sanitizing soap, you know, just a little bit quick, and then, okay, let's take your blood pressure. Or if the doc were going to check out something in our mouth, once again, maybe a glove in that particular case, maybe a little hand sanitizing soap, open up, and then we're done. There would be no elaborate cleaning rituals for the kinds of things that I just mentioned. It is only when the doctor is going to open up a person for surgery that we see the kind of process being undergone that we have just outlined. If a person gets an infection after surgery, chances are that the surgeon is going to be blamed because they're going to say it is traceable back to you. Now, again, imagine going to the doctor tomorrow to have her blood pressure checked, or he's going to check out her consoles. And the doctor says, now, wait a minute. He goes through all the steps that we looked at on two slides, all those steps. Now, can you imagine what you'd be thinking as the doctor performs all of this laborious effort? And then if you can imagine that, let's flip the illustration around a little bit. What if tomorrow you're not going to have your blood pressure checked out? You're not going to have your tonsils looked at, but tomorrow you're going under the knife. You're going to have open heart surgery. So the attendant comes out and they wheel you into the surgical suite. And the doctor comes waltzing into the surgical suite. He has no mask. He has no gown. He has no gloves. He is, you can see him just finishing up his chili cheese dog that somebody handed him as he went through the drive-thru. And the doc gives you a big smile and he waves his hand and says, good to see you. We're just about getting ready to start. And then he says, well, I better use a little hand sanitizer. So he takes the little container hand sanitizer out of his pocket and then rubs a little bit in his hands and says, okay, you know, now we're good to go. Who has the scalpel? Now, if that were you, would you not be thinking, how am I going to get off the gurney and how am I going to make it out the quickest exit? I do not want this man operating on me based on what I'm seeing. There are men who are like the Pharisees, who are like a messed up doctor. They had these elaborate washings. They went through these great rituals for things that would be like checking somebody's blood pressure or checking somebody's tonsils. It made no sense. But then when it came to being like the heart surgeon and the things which really mattered, and you would want this kind of elaborate ritual, they were like the surgeon with dirty hands. They were all messed up. I don't know if you've ever thought about the hands of Jesus or not, but that's tonight what I want us to spend some time thinking about. The hands of Jesus, in contrast to the hands of men like the Pharisees, the hands were very, very different. And they were very different for a couple of reasons. If you think about Jesus and the disciples, they, as you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're going from town to town, place to place, village to village. And as they traveled, they didn't have the nice accommodations that we have, staying in nice hotels, and they didn't have cars that would keep them out of the dust and dirt and those kinds of things, no. There were no washing machines for them in the various towns. There were no public laundromats. So even if they were able to find a place for where they could have some water, maybe a well, maybe a river, soap was certainly something that was not available to the degree that we have it now. When you begin to think about the hands of Jesus, all the traveling that he did, they were surely men, Jesus and the apostles, who if you looked at their physical hands, there was dirt. There was grime on their hands many, many days. And Jesus actually hints about that. When you think about Jesus washing the feet of the apostles, why did he do that? Well, he did that because in that particular culture, you're out there in the dust, you're out there in the dirt, and your feet are going to get dirty, and chances are your hands are going to get dirty. There's some religious groups today who use foot washing as some kind of church ordinance. They want some kind of quaint ceremony, and perhaps that's required by the group, or at least they practice it, but that's not what we have in this particular culture. You're out there walking. You're walking in a culture which is very dusty, and it's not going to take very long before your feet are covered. They are plastered with dirt. So it was a great act of hospitality to go and wash the feet. Men like the Pharisees, though, if we could go back in time 2,000 years and we could look at the Pharisees on a daily basis, you probably would find that they would have had, by and large, clean hands. I mean, the hands would not have been the hands of a laborer. Have you ever looked at the hands of a laborer? Or if you are a laborer, you look at your hands from time to time? Or you think about the hands of a mechanic? Oftentimes, you go up and you meet the person, and my hands are not clean today. Well, that's okay, but, you know, they're greasy, they're slimy. I've got rough hands. When you look at the Pharisees, they were not the people who were the manual laborers of the day. They were the people who would have lived in probably the nicer homes, and when you looked at their hands, they would have been clean hands. You know, nice, shiny, and they are not rough hands. So when Jesus comes along, he begins to talk about hands with the Pharisees because they were paying great attention to the hands. And he said, you Pharisees, you are putting all the attention on the outside. Your hands look good. Oh, if they held up their hands, look, no dirt. They're spotless. And look at what we're doing with our hands. We're washing our hands before we eat bread. We're washing our hands before we drink anything. Germs and dirt were not on their minds. But on God's mind was something that was a lot more important. And what was on the mind of God was the heart. When we think about Moses' law, animal sacrifices were in effect for thousands of years. And under that system, we find at different times in Hebrew history, God was not pleased with the sacrifices his people were making. As we look at the close of the Old Testament, notice Malachi chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. God said, you're bringing your offerings, you're bringing your animals for sacrifice. But God said, what's the quality of the animals that you're bringing? God said that you're bringing the blind animals. Who wants a blind sheep? Who wants a blind animal? Well, we really can't do much. And they're not very valuable. Let's give them to God. God said, is that not evil? And God said, the sick animals that you have, we don't want to eat it. And we can't trade it. We can't sell it. What can we do with our sick animal? What can we do with the lame animal? Let's give it to God. And we'll satisfy the offering. God said, is that not evil? God said, what if you take that animal that's sick and blind and lame and you give it to the governor? Is he going to be pleased? Would he want that on his meal table? Well, obviously not. They knew the answer to that question. If you live in the country, or if you have lived in the country, perhaps you've been in a position where you had some food that was excess. Maybe you thought this is not fit for human consumption. It was something that was cut off, maybe some gristle, and you threw that outside and you figured that the animals would get it. Or maybe if you've had a dog around the house, an inside dog, a pet, you have offered that animal table scraps. The Jews were offering scraps to God. They were taking the junk. They were taking what was not even a good leftover. And there were times where the Jews apparently believed that God, as long as he got some offering, that he would be pleased, he would accept with whatever the people offered. Imagine if somebody, and I know this is not exactly a parallel, but imagine if somebody invited you over for a meal. They wanted to show that they had appreciation for you, they wanted to show an interest in you, and you go over there and you find that they are rooting through the garbage can, looking for food to prepare for the evening meal. How would you feel? Well, certainly you would not feel like an honored guest. You would feel like, you know, they're disrespecting me. They have no regard for me. Are they really, really going to get the food for tonight's meal from the trash can? And that's what God's people were doing. This isn't fit for anybody or anything else, so let's give it to God. God said his people had a heart problem. Jesus, many years later, we get through that 400-year silent period, and we find that the Lord said there were Pharisees and others who also had heart problems. These men wanted to be seen as religious. They wanted to get the badge. They wanted to have the certificate. And Jesus said, you're really nothing more than performers. The Lord said, you give the appearance of being holy. You look like you are righteous people. But Jesus said, I can look into the center of your life. I can see your true core. And I am telling you that you are evil. I am telling you that you are wicked. I am telling you that you are nothing more than pretenders. Take a look at Matthew chapter 23 and verse 27. Jesus, when he goes after these fellows, and several times in Matthew chapter 23, he uses the word woe. And that is a word of warning. It is a word of judgment. It is a way of saying bad news. Woe, woe, woe unto you scribes and Pharisees. You're hypocrites, exclamation mark. Why? He said, you are similar to a whited sepulcher, a whited grave. He said, outwardly that grave looks beautiful. Outwardly that grave looks like it is an attractive place. But he said, inwardly, do you know what the grave is like? If you were to open up the tomb, can you think about the stench? Can you think about the filth? Can you think about the awfulness? Can you think about the decay that is inside that grave? Jesus said, this is a great picture of what you are like. The Lord knew that these Jews, they were good. They excelled at scrubbing graves. There were people when it was times like the Passover, the ceremonial defilement, people didn't want to walk across the grave. They had been taught about that as far as defilement. So the Jews, they would go out there and they would whitewash the graves. So as people came up and they saw the beautiful whitewashing that had been done, they would know that that was a cemetery area and stay away from there. When the Jews did that, those areas looked pretty. Even now, if you go out into a cemetery, a graveyard, you can find some stones which you say, that's an attractive stone. Maybe that's more attractive than some of the landscaping that we have at our house. But Jesus says, no matter how beautiful the exterior looks, you can't change the inside. You can scrub it, you can paint it, you can whitewash it, you can paper over it, but on the inside there is still the filth, there is still the corruption, there is still the rottenness. And Jesus said to these people, that is what your life is like. You've prettied up the outside, and perhaps that's all that people can see, but it is exterior only. Throughout the Bible, we find that God has always required that man's heart be right with him. A heart right with God is not being a good person. That's what many in the world think. But a heart right with God is one who becomes a Christian and then truly tries to live the Christian life. The Jews could have offered thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of sacrifices and the right animal every single time. But if the heart was not truly in it, it was worthless. For us, we can translate that into the Christian era. We can be baptized for the right reason, for the forgiveness of sins. But if our heart is not really in us, it's just an exterior act. It does no good. We can attend worship, and we can go through all the motions week after week, and everything from the exterior, it looks right, it looks good. A person may come and a person may sing on key, hit all the right notes, follow along just like everybody else. When it comes to the Lord's Supper, we can breeze through that as well. And from the outside, it looks good. When people pray, we can follow along or at least give that impression. When there's teaching that's done, we can at least to some degree follow that. And we might even make an offering. But if the heart is not in it, we're no different than the Jews, who were like whited tombs, rotting inside. Now someone says, well, you know, there are times where I'm just doing well to show up. Been a rough week with the kids, been a hard week at work. I'm kind of preoccupied. Yeah, those times come. But that's not what we're talking about tonight. At services, living the Christian life, there are always going to be times where we have some distractions. But we are talking about the kind of person who is a habitual offender. The kind of person that this is their way of life. It is nothing but an exterior show. It's like a thin veneer that's not even really a good veneer. Jesus says that kind of life puts a person on dangerous ground. In life, oftentimes we're told that we must qualify for something. If you've ever decided that you wanted to buy a house and you didn't have all the money that you needed, you probably went down to a bank, a credit union, or someone else and said, we'd like a loan. And maybe the loan officer said, you need to qualify. We need to make sure that you are qualified for the loan. If you've ever applied for a credit card, maybe the credit card company said, we need to qualify you. We need to make sure that You know, you are credit worthy and you have enough income to pay the bills when they come due. When we think about job seekers, oftentimes they're told that they must qualify for the job. Even in the realm of sports, we find that there are qualifications. God says, I have some qualifications. If you want to be one of my people, if you want to go to heaven, there are some qualifications which you must meet. And if you don't meet those, you're not going to make it. One of God's criteria, we might say at the top of the list or the bottom of the list, depending on how you want to look at it, one of those criteria is truly giving our heart to God. When we start looking around at our country right now, we find a lot of hearts which are really just like the Pharisees. We find that as we look at our nation in this area and certainly outside this area, we have a lot of people who have chosen a faith. They have decided to adopt a faith which is like the clean hands of the Pharisees. Last month, Gallup released a poll. This goes back to May 2022. And they entitled this poll, A New Low. They said right now, 81% of all Americans believe in God. And they're calling that a decline compared to years past. They said right now, if you were to look at the population of the United States, about a fourth of the people who live in this country no longer believe in God. We're going to come back to the third point, but 42%, they believe that God hears and intervenes on behalf of the individual. Only 30% of young adults, 18 to 29, believe that. And there's been an even steeper decline in church attendance. In fact, if you're not aware of it, we have every week religious groups, sometimes including the church in this country, they're shutting their doors. They're calling it quits. They're saying we're done or we can't continue. Back in 1944, instead of 81%, we had that percentage at 96%, about 15% higher. Surveys indicate that fewer people believe in God. And even for those who do believe in God, let's go back to that third point. Only 42% believe that God hears prayers and intervenes. If the survey is right, and I think that they are, as far as what they're putting out, more than half of our nation, roughly 40% of our nation says, well, we will acknowledge a belief in God, but we do not believe that God is capable of doing anything. God is ineffective. Or if you want to be really dramatic, they would, and they wouldn't state it quite this way, but it essentially boils down to God is dead. He is so powerless. He is worth nothing. We might as well worship a piece of wood. That's 60% of our nation. We're sliding in a hurry into a pit that we may not be able to come out of. America has changed. And America is changing. And that change is not for the better. Some parts of our nation are beginning to show this decay faster than others. We have in our country right now a spiritual cancer. And we see it from a lot of different perspectives. If you talk to parents, and it may be in this community, it may be elsewhere, but I'll tell you what I'm hearing from some parents as they talk about the school where the children go and perhaps why they've pulled their kids out of school. The latest one said that this school system is a dumpster fire. And that's a person who is not prone to exaggeration. They're looking at what's being taught to people in that school system, to young people, and they have said, we will not allow our children to be exposed to that anymore. And that's not some third world country. That's not some place way across the sea. Do you know, have you seen that in some large cities on the coast that we have literally dozens, and I don't mean 5 or 10 or 12 people, I mean dozens, 60 or perhaps 70, maybe closer to 100. In places like New York, you look at some of the larger cities, you might have 600 district assistant district attorney offices, or 600 different district attorneys that are working for the main DA. I figured that out a long time ago. When we live around here, we're thinking, okay, we've got the DA, and maybe if there's an assistant DA in our area, we just don't see dozens and dozens or hundreds of additional prosecutors. But in large cities, that's what you have. Maybe 600 or 700 different people who are prosecuting attorneys in the office of the DA. And in a lot of these cities, you have dozens, literally dozens of assistant district attorneys resigning. They're calling it quits. One source that I looked at today said that some DAs, some assistant DAs, see themselves as really file clerks. Crimes are brought to their attention. The police say, we saw this person engaging in robbery or something else, well, we're not going to charge them. And rather than being a prosecutor, rather than doing the job that they're being paid to do, they're simply paid to be a file clerk. And this is coming from sources that are not conservative sources. If you're familiar with the New York Times, that's not exactly a conservative news publication. But there was, within the last 24 hours, even an article in the New York Times which talked about the fact that assistant district attorneys are literally leaving in droves. As we live in a country which is literally almost at the speed of light, it seems like some days, moving further and further away from the Bible, it is more important than ever for us to think about our hands in the way that we're talking about tonight. For a lot of people in America, looking at what we have here in the slide, their faith is nothing more than what we see with the Pharisees in Luke chapter 11 and Mark chapter 7. They want it to look good. They want to be seen as religious. Oh, I have my church and I have a Bible and I do a little of this and I've got a Bible app on my smartphone. But God says, here's what I want. I want you to be like that surgeon who is scrubbing for surgery. I want you to be that person who looks at your life, every nook, every cranny, every corner. And I want you to check out your life. I want you to examine your life in light of my word. And I want you to look for that dirt. I want you to look for those germs. And I want you to be a truly holy people. The guitar has always fascinated me. I played saxophone for a while, messed with a few other instruments, but the guitar has always kind of fascinated me. Picked a few up. Actually strummed a few times, a little. I don't know that I was actually playing any music, but I thought it was always a fascinating instrument. But you know, I've never really had an interest in the guitar to the point where I wanted to learn it. I do know enough about the guitar that if you really want to get good, you're probably going to have hours of practice, you're going to have some raw fingers, you're going to have some sore fingers, and chances are your fingers are going to bleed if you're going to become a good guitar player. And for me, it's not worth the cost. Oh, I'll pick it up, I'll look at it, maybe try to make a little sound. But I'm not willing to invest the effort. And that's what we have when we think about a lot of the people in America right now. I'm not really going to put the effort into God. I have just the shell of a faith. We need to do our best to pierce the shell that people have and say, you might be on the right road, but you're so far from the place where God wants you to be. If you continue on this course, the Bible teaches that you are not in a right relationship with Him and heaven will not be your home. How many of us will be alive in 50 years if the Lord doesn't come? I don't know. Chances are at least some will. And chances are that if we are not out there trying to tell people, look, there is a God. This is His word. We're accountable to Him. And He's paying attention. In 50 years, America may not be here. Or if it is here, it's probably not going to be the America that we know today. Time is short. Sin is becoming more and more visible in some ways that we could not conceive of 20 years ago. We need to be praying every day for America, but we also need to make sure that our hands, spiritually speaking, are like what God describes, and that is they reflect a pure heart. Tonight, we believe that you want to live in that kind of way. If you're not yet a Christian, there's at least one more opportunity to do that. If you have become a Christian and there's some things that you need to get right with God, there will never be a better time than now. And if we can help, we'd like to do that as we stand and sing.